Adventures in Research. This is Paul Shannon bringing you another transcribed story of science produced as a public service in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. And today bringing you the unusual story of an immigrant boy named Michael Pupin, who came to America penniless and unlearned, but through determination and industry rose to fame as an educator and inventor in his adopted land. Some 80 or 85 years ago, in a small Serbian village of Ivor, there lived a farm family by the name of Pupin. Life was hard, and everyone had to do his share of work, even young Michael, 12 years of age.
Now, Michael,
listen closely to what I say.
Yes, Father.
I have brought you here tonight to the pasture to watch the oxen. It's very dark and no easy task for a small boy. Now, during the day, the sun and the heat force the oxen to keep cool under the shade trees. But at night, they are hungry and wish to feed. Now, do you see that cornfield over there?
Yes, Father.
When a breeze from the cornfield carries the sweetness of the young corn to the oxen, they will stray into those fields unless you watch them.
Oh, I will watch them closely, Father. Very closely.
Watching is not enough. A greater danger hides in the cornfield.
Danger, Father?
Cattle thieves. They hide in the cornfields at night, and whenever an ox strays there to feast on the corn, they steal the animal away in the dark.
How shall I prevent this?
See this long knife?
Yes, Father.
Now, I stick it deep into the earth. So. Now, lie down, Michael, and press your ear against the earth. Close. Now, are you ready?
Ready, Father.
Now I will strike the wooden handle of the knife. Do you hear it, son?
Well, very clearly.
Now, press your ear against the handle of the knife. Tell me, what do you hear now?
I hear... Yes, it is the sound of the hooves of the oxen moving about in the pasture.
That is right.
Why is this, Father?
In Serbia, among the farmers, it is an old custom. We know that sound travels through the ground far better than through the air. And hard earth carries sound much better than plowed up earth. So, Michael, it is your duty to lie here at night with your ear pressed against the knife's handle. Should you hear the oxen stray away into the cornfields, strike the handle of your knife sharply. Now that will signal other boys in the pasture nearby, and they will come running to help you.
And the cattle thieves, will they not hear our signal?
Where they hide, the earth is soft. They will not hear your signal.
This was Michael Pupin's first acquaintanceship with the phenomena of mechanical vibrations, a fact which stood him in good stead in later years. A few years later, the Pupin family gave permission to Michael to leave for America, there to seek his fortune.
My son, we are poor, and therefore cannot send you out into the world blessed with riches. But advice from a father's heart, this I can give to you. Michael, my son, if you wish to make your name in the world, provide yourself with another pair of eyes, the eyes of reading and writing. Learning is the light which illuminates our path through this life and leads to a future life of everlasting glory.
The ship carrying young Pupin to America docked at Hoboken, and the immigrants transferred to Castle Garden to be questioned by the admittance officers.
How old are you, boy?
15.
What country?
Serbia.
Well, the immigration law of this country requires that you have sufficient funds on your person so that you will not become a public charge. How much money did you bring with you to America?
Oh, only this much.
5 cents? Why, you must be joking.
That is all I have.
Do you have relatives here?
No relatives.
Any friends?
No friends.
Don't you know anyone in this country?
Oh, yes. Yes, in Serbia, I study in school about Benjamin Franklin and his kite, and I know Abraham Lincoln, and I know Uncle Tom's cabin.
Well, you chose good company, boy, but not much help in getting you admitted. Do you have a trade?
What does this mean, trade?
Well, have you ever worked at anything such as farming, carpentry, stonemason, shoemaker, tailor?
No, nothing. But I will learn. This is what brings me to America, to learn.
5 cents to your name. No relatives, no friends, and no skills. Oh, you're a very poor risk.
Risk? What is this risk?
It's... Oh, well, forget it. I'll make an exception in your case. Okay, go ahead.
Michael Pepin was permitted to enter America. To keep alive, he did farm work in Maryland, tended mules in Delaware, painted basements in Philadelphia, and finally found employment in a cracker factory in New York. In the factory, he made friends with a boiler room engineer who took an interest in the young immigrant.
That's enough, coal boy. Shut the door. Sit yourself down and rest. You still want to be a fireman when you grow up, Michael?
Oh, yes. A boiler fireman like you, Mr. Jim.
No, my lad. You must aim higher, much higher. That takes book learning. Here, I brought you a present. It's second hand, but it's still good.
Oh, a book. Oh, thank you, Mr. Jim.
It's a dictionary. The first thing you got to do is learn English. Every time you come across a new word that you don't understand, you just look it up in this book.
Oh, I will look it up, yes.
Next, you must go to school.
That is my dream.
A cousin of mine goes to Cooper Union Night School. I'll talk to him, see about getting you into classes.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Jim. I wish to learn very much.
Well, that's the right idea, boy. This is a growing country. There's opportunity all over this land. Study. Go to school. Prepare yourself for when your chance comes.
The boiler engineer, true to his word, got young Pepin admitted to school. Every spare moment at work, he made his young pupil memorize famous personalities and documents in American history.
For the people shall not perish from this earth.
Very good, Michael. Very good.
I am speaking English better, yes?
Oh, much better. Tomorrow we'll try my favorite poem, The Village Blacksmith.
Mr. Jim.
Yes, Michael?
In the library at school is a big picture with many fine-looking men. Some sit, some stand.
Well, what about it?
These men, who are they? Names like McCormick, Morse, Howe, Whitney, Morton. Mr. Jim, what did these men do?
Well, let's see. Morse invented the telegraph, McCormick the reaper, Howe the sewing machine. Most of these names belong to inventors, men of science.
Like Benjamin Franklin and his kite?
Well, that's right, like Franklin.
This is what I wish to become, a man of science, like these men in the picture.
Soon, Michael Pepin was just that, a man of science. At 21, he entered Columbia College, winning the coveted Tyndall Fellowship for Advanced Study at Cambridge. Abroad, he became fascinated by the Faraday-Maxwell electromagnetic theory. After a year at Cambridge, he transferred to the University of Berlin to complete his doctorate under the famous German physicist von Helmholtz. On his return to America in 1889, Dr. Pepin was assigned to teach mathematical physics in the new Department of Electrical Engineering at Columbia. With his assistant, Crocker, the two men went to examine their new quarters.
Well, Crocker, what do you think of our new home?
The truth?
Naturally, the truth.
It looks like a cow shed.
Oh, yes, it isn't very large.
Nor is our laboratory too well equipped. One motor, one dynamo, an alternator, and some measuring instruments.
And two green instructors.
Oh, we will expand, Crocker. It's up to us to expand if we want to make any impression upon the electrical art.
Oh, we'll expand, Professor. Be sure of that.
Yeah, what makes you so confident?
You have no idea how rapidly an inexperienced teacher expands when he tries to teach a new subject to pupils who are poorly prepared.
The basic theoretical courses in electrical engineering were taught by Dr. Pupin in the morning. In the afternoon, he gave laboratory instruction. In the evening, working in the cowshed, he found time to carry on experimental research. And from this came Michael Pupin, the inventor. All of us know today that it's a simple thing to tune a radio. Just by twisting a dial or pushing a button, we get music, drama, sports, like magic. But when wireless or radio first came into being, this magic was unknown. A big problem was how to send and receive messages so they would not interfere with one another. This problem was solved by Michael Pupin.
In an electrical circuit having a coil and a condenser, the moving electricity has a definite inertia and a definite electrical stiffness. Hence, it will have a definite pitch or frequency, just like a tuning fork or even a vibrating knife stuck into the hard ground. It is obvious, therefore, that an electrical resonator, the pitch of which can be changed by adjusting its coil or condenser or both, is a perfect parallel to the acoustical resonator. I call my invention selective tuning.
Electrical tuning was not the only invention of the immigrant inventor. He perfected a type of telephone repeater or induction coil, which first made possible long-distance telephony.
The electrical vibrations in a telephone line can be likened to the simple mechanical motions in a vibrating string. Small weights placed along the string at several intervals of the wavelength will enable the desired frequencies to be transmitted much more efficiently than otherwise. So it is with the telephone line. Localized induction coils placed at predetermined intervals in the line will maintain the desired tone distinctions and power of signal.
Michael Pupin was indeed a versatile man of science. He discovered secondary X-ray radiation and made a long list of contributions to the wide field of telegraph, telephone, and wireless communication. And honors and prizes came to the immigrant inventor.
The Elliott Crescent Medal for Distinction in Physics.
The Presidency of the Institute of Radio Engineers.
The Edison Medal. The Hebert Prize of the French Academy.
The Presidency of the New York Academy of Science.
18 honorary degrees.
Scientist, inspiring teacher, inventor. Such was the career of Michael Pupin, the one-time Serbian shepherd boy, who made of his opportunities in a free land an inspiring adventure in research. And that's today's Adventures in Research, produced in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. These programs are broadcast to armed forces personnel overseas through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Join us again next week for another transcribed story of science on Adventures in Research. Adventures in Research. This is Paul Shannon bringing you another transcribed story of science produced as a public service of a Hungarian doctor, Ignaz Philipp Semmelweis, who back before the days of the miracles of modern medicine waged a lifelong battle for cleanliness and sterility in hospitals. Our story begins in Vienna in 1837, where young Semmelweis has just come to study law. Free of parental restraint, the young man entered into the gay life of the city. One day, just for a lark, he joined a medical student, a friend, Felix, in witnessing an anatomy demonstration.
My, how high this place is. What do you call it?
Shh, you mustn't talk here. It's forbidden. This is our surgical theater.
So this is the torture chamber where you fellows do your butchery.
Ignatz, please, I beg you, don't talk.
Well, the show, when does it begin?
Presently. Just sit here quietly in the back and observe.
That fellow down there under the light with the frock coat and red beard, who is he?
That is Dr. Krakauer, a very famous surgeon. Oh, see, what did I tell you? He's looking up here.
And who's that lying on the table?
The patient for the demonstration.
Felix, isn't that a woman?
Was, you mean.
But I don't understand. She's so young. So young. How did it happen?
Childbed fever. Shh. Krakauer is ready to begin. Semmelweis, where are you going? Aren't you staying for a demonstration?
Semmelweis had seen enough. In 1837, childbed fever was killing one out of five married women between the ages of 15 and 44. The young law student was so impressed by what he had seen that the very next day he wrote to his family in Budapest.
I must confess to you, my dear parents, that I have no sincere interest in the study of law. My mind and heart, I fear, are unsuited for law courts and the haggling over legal contracts.
Papa, does Ignatz mean he no longer wishes to become a lawyer?
Yeah, it looks that way, Mama.
Oh, such a boy. Well, what does he want to do?
If you will let me finish reading his letter, maybe I will find out. So, with your permission, my beloved parents, I should like to take up the study of medicine, particularly in the field of obstetrics, to which I should like to devote my life.
Papa, is our Ignatz out of his mind? Obstetrics?
Yeah, just not good. I told you, Mama, not to send him to Vienna. All that music and
it will go.
In April 1844, young Dr. Semmelweis, serious and devoted to his new profession, joined the notorious 1st Maternity Division of the Vienna General Hospital. Notorious, yes, because during his first month there, he saw 36 out of 208 mothers die of the dreaded childbed fever. He walked among these women, helpless, not knowing what to do.
Doctor.
Yeah, my good woman. What can I do for you?
Water. I'm burning with fever. Water.
Here. Drink.
More.
No, that's enough for now. Try to rest. The fever will go away soon. Don't worry. It will go away.
But it didn't go away. During the next 2 years, 1844 to 1846, Dr. Semmelweis watched his female patients die, one by one, row after row in the hospital. He spent days, nights, in the autopsy laboratory, searching for a clue to the dreaded fever. And then, one day, while walking through the halls of the hospital, he accidentally bumped into an old friend.
Felix! My old friend Felix, it's good to see you.
Semmelweis, how are you? And how do you like being a doctor?
Well, frankly, not much. Sometimes I feel that I should have continued with law. That is easier. No heartaches, no sleepless nights. But what brings you here?
Oh, bad news. I have just received word that my best friend, the pathologist Kolechko...
A very brilliant fellow. What about him?
He died this morning.
How?
Blood poisoning. Some careless student was assisting him at an autopsy. The knife slipped and he cut Kolechka.
Wait, Felix. You say A poison was transferred from a patient by a knife directly into Kolechka's blood.
Exactly.
Blood poison at an autopsy?
Yes. What are you driving at, Semmelweis?
This is most interesting, if this is true. But wait, I must see the report of Kolechka's postmortem. And if this is true, if it is true...
Semmelweis's fingers trembled as he read the report. Yes, the death of Kolechka was due to blood poisoning. In black and white, there it was. Blood poisoning.
Yeah, the wound of the student's knife slip carried the invisible poison of the autopsy into Kolechka. So death is not generated always inside our bodies, but can sneak into us from outside. Perhaps the same is true of these dying mothers. The doctors come straight from autopsy rooms to the examining rooms. Perhaps we bring blood poison with us on our hands. Our dirty hands. They are the real murderers of these women.
Long before Pasteur, long before Koch and Lister, Ignaz Philipp Semmelweis had stumbled on the cold fact that microbes, poisons from outside the body, can kill patients. Overnight, he became a fanatic about cleanliness, about washing the hands of all who had contact with sick patients.
Dirigitur clementissime pater in nomine patris et filii et spiritus sancti.
Doctor, yeah, doctor, please, let me go home. Let me have my child at home. I will die here. I know it. Please, Dr. Semmelweis.
Just have courage and rest.
Oh, rest? How can I rest when I know I shall die like all the others? How can I rest, Herr Doctor, when I'm all day reminded of death? That bell. The priest's bell.
Dr. Schultz.
Yeah, Dr. Semmelweis?
Do me a favor. Ask the priest not to march through these wards with his death bell.
Yeah, Dr. Semmelweis.
And, Dr. Schultz, do these women a favor. Wash your hands before you come into the wards.
My hands? Why, they're clean.
Dr. Schultz, where were you before you made your rounds in number one clinic?
Not in my laboratory.
So?
We were performing an autopsy on the patient who died of fever.
And from there, you came directly to this ward to examine these women. Isn't that so?
Dr. Semmelweis, I object to your constant questions. You are not an attorney, nor am I a criminal.
That remains to be seen. Did you wash your hands after you left that unfortunate woman in the autopsy?
My hands are clean. See for yourself.
On the surface, yes. But did it ever occur to you, Doctor, that even your hands may carry disease?
The next day found Dr. Semmelweis with the chief of the obstetrical staff, Dr. Klein.
Semmelweis, you are making a fetish of this cleanliness.
Since when is death a fetish?
But the causes of the fever are well known. Even the great Virchow will tell you that the fever is due to an invisible miasma, bad air, atmospheric cosmic telluric influences. That's what's killing these mothers.
Fancy words to hide ignorance. I tell you the fever is caused by dirty hands, contaminated hands. If your interns would take the trouble of washing their hands with chlorine water, fewer women would die in your hospital.
And how do you know, Herr Dr. Semmelweis?
Because I have been gathering facts. Here in the hospital, we have two obstetrical clinics. In clinic number one, the mortality rate is 11.3%. And in clinic number two, the mortality rate is only 2.7%. Now listen to this. In clinic number one, the patients are examined by interns whose hands are contaminated in the autopsy laboratory. But in clinic number two, only midwives examine the patients. And midwives, as you well know, never go near the autopsy room. Therefore, I conclude, less contamination, fewer deaths.
A very pretty hypothesis proving nothing.
And I reply, if you had eyes, you would find proof right under your very nose.
Semmelweis, for a long time I've been thinking of discharging you for your attitude and insult.
Yes, that would eliminate Semmelweis, but not the fever. Dr. Klein, my appointment here ends a year from now. Let me prove to you in that year that my hypothesis is correct. Whatever our personal differences, you are a scientist. Let me try my experiment. Let me wash the hands of your staff in clinic number one.
The next morning, there was an unusual announcement in the hospital. All interns, nurses, orderlies, students, and yes, even the dignified doctors were ordered to assemble in clinic number one.
These are the orders. I want the delivery room spotless. Clean sheets, sterile clothing, sterile sponges, antiseptic instruments. Do not come near a patient with dirty hands. I beseech you, implore you, wash your hands. Soap and water alone will not suffice. Soak your hands in a solution of chloride of lime. I will give you a demonstration.
And so Semmelweis began. First he lathered his hands with soap excessively, then washing them in water over and over again. Then he plunged his hands into a basin of chlorine water. Here he washed and rinsed his hands so long that they turned red. The bored group looked on. At last, Semmelweis's hands became slippery. He holds them up to his nose. He sniffs, and then he nods.
Now, my hands are clean.
As simple as all that, Semmelweis washed the doctor's hands clean of death. In 3 weeks, after he insisted that everyone wash his hands, he reported to Dr. Klein.
The mortality rate in clinic number one has dropped from 11.3 to only 3%.
And at the end of the year, he reported...
Mortality rate dropped from 3% to the all-time low in the Vienna lying-in hospital of only a little over 1%.
And in that same year, Dr. Klein reported...
Semmelweis, you are discharged.
I have been expecting that, Dr. Klein, but I've proven my point. We know how to wipe out childbed fever. We have saved the lives of thousands of women.
You are impetuous. You quarrel. You cannot take orders.
Wrong again, Dr. Klein. I can take orders. Goodbye.
But that wasn't the last the world heard of Dr. Semmelweis. There came a day when he was proved correct. When his ideas were accepted and expanded to make possible the antiseptically clean, spotless hospital of today. But Ignaz Philipp Semmelweis saw little progress in this direction, for he became a victim of the very sickness he was trying to eradicate. While working on childbed fever, he died of the same septic infection. Later, Sir William J. Sinclair of the University of Manchester wrote these words.
We deplore the martyrdom of Semmelweis. But we can find some comfort in the reflection that he did not struggle in vain. The whole civilized world was soon to enjoy the fruits of his discovery. He shed the light of scientific progress on a region hitherto shrouded in the darkness of night.
And that's today's Adventures in Research, produced in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. These programs are broadcast to Armed Forces personnel overseas through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Join us again next week for another transcribed story of science on Adventures in Research.